Well, what I'd like to do in the time that remains is to talk about the three things that Professor Collins raised about the Urantia Book's teachings about life, the origin of life on Earth, the origin of the Earth, and the origin of the universe, and discuss the current scientific evidence and hopefully provide you some insight into the real status of science on things like this, which Professor Collins does not seem to have appreciated or has bypassed in the way he used this material. And I'm doing this partially to continue a criticism of the theological way of looking at things, but also partially to provide a lead-in to the subject I expect to take up tomorrow night, which, and then as a preview, trying to build attendance and all that. I would like to look at things that are in the science of the Urantia Book that could be taken to indicate its revelatory authority, to look for things that are unexpected, things that it presents that are novel, that were not accepted. Let's say, to turn Professor Collins's argument on his head, things that were not accepted prior to 1950, that were in fact contrary and heterodox rather than orthodox, and that are now accepted as scientific truth. Now, I've already argued that this method of argument doesn't really prove anything, but given the fact that so many people find it persuasive, I would like to bring out some of these things and discuss them. I think it's something people find interesting. If time permits, then we'll go into some other aspects of science in the book, too. I'm sort of playing this by ear. Okay, the origin of life on Earth. I'm just putting this up to refresh your memory about what Professor Collins' argument was that there were two methods that had been recognized scientifically, that life arose spontaneously from various atoms and molecules in a primordial soup getting it together over billions of years, or that ancient astronauts had come and implanted life. In some sense, either of those theories could be made to sort of fit or be consistent with the Urantia Book explanation, and in some ways it was better than either of them. And so he sort of liked the method. And then there was this question of time, and I thought it was interesting that he spent, I think, a third of his talk discussing the method and how these methods fit together. And then when he came to the time, he said, but the time's wrong, so it's nonsense, and just went on. I'd like to focus on the time thing a little bit. There is a problem here. There have been discovered within the last, let's say, 10 years roughly, two types of fossil evidence that are believed to indicate an origin of life as much as 3.5 to 4 billion years ago. I think it's important, though, when you start to look at something like this, to look at what the actual factual evidence is and not to get tied up in what Professor Jones's theory of it may be, because in science you have to deal with the facts and the theories, and there's a very complicated interplay going on all the time, and the facts are often much less convincing or persuasive than the theories. The theories usually involve building an awful lot on the facts, extrapolating a lot from the facts. And it's often the theories that find their way into the popular literature. I guess I could beat Carl Sagan for a moment. In his TV series, there was a lot of presentation of astronomical and cosmological theories without a whole lot of presentation of the facts that support them. And yet, in his writings, there is much written that shows that he has a very full appreciation of the tenuous nature of the theorizing. And it's sort of like the more intense the medium the presentation is in, the sort of the more focused and superficial the presentation becomes. When Sagan is on screen, you would think it was God's truth, and when you read it in his book, it's qualified and explained and put in much more realistic perspective. And that's true of a lot of things. Some writers don't bother, though, which is too bad. Anyway, there are certain facts that get into this 3.5 million year figure. There are two geological formations in which things have been observed that people think may be early life forms. One is a type of deposit. I wish I had some pictures to show you what it looks like. Well, let me say that around the coast of Australia, there is a type of geological formation which you can see growing today. And it's called a stromatolite. It's a formation that's created by a blanket of algae growing over rocks. And the algae grow generation after generation. And while they don't have hard skeletons like the calciferous foraminifera, God, what a wonderful word, I got it out, that created all the great limestone beds and so forth of geological history, the algae do pick up certain insoluble material in their metabolism. And over a period of centuries, the individual cells dying build up an accumulation of solid matter. And the bed on which the algae are growing gets thicker and thicker and thicker. And it displays striations that reflect changes in the viability of the algae that are growing. And there are, in Australia, I guess they're associated with natural hot springs, come to think of it. I'm not really sure. There are formations today that have this structure. Well, one of the important pieces of evidence suggesting life was the discovery in what are called Precambrian rock formations, which basically is rock formations belonging to a geological order more than 550 million years ago, roughly. There was the discovery of formations that, when examined microscopically in cross-section, had the same structure as the living stromatolites that you can find today, or stromatoliths. I think the living ones are called stromatolites and the dead ones are stromatoliths, you know, sort of like stalactites and stalagmites or something. Well, anyway. In any case, they observed these in rock formations that were of great antiquity, much greater than anything that life was observed in, and they made certain projections of the age of these formations based on postulated rates of growth. In other words, they guessed how fast these things would form given the rates of formation of the observable living ones, and concluded that the foundation of these stromatoliths must have been laid down several billion years ago based on the thickness of the formation and the age of the rock, the overlying rock. Well, you know, you're left with the question, what they observed, was it actually the product of a living life process? Or was it the product of something that was some sort of pre-life, or some sort of mechanical life, or some sort of chemical or physical process that existed in the early Earth? Or perhaps did the conditions during which, but maybe it was a living product, but the conditions under which it were laid down were conducive to a more rapid rate of growth than the modern conditions. Also, there's the question, was the formation really overlaid by rocks of the necessary antiquity to establish its date? Or did it somehow represent some kind of later intrusion that had grown in place, perhaps as the result of liquids percolating through seams in the rock or something? Well, for various reasons, the consensus has been generally, I mean, at least among the people who discovered these things, to reject this and to claim that they believe that these do point to the origin of some sort of algae-like life form several billion years ago. But I bring it up sort of to show that there is a fairly complicated chain of inference. You have to make a lot of arguments stick together to come to the conclusion that these particular rock formations are the product of life and are at least of this age. It's not real hard evidence. On the other hand, a geologist would defend it by saying, well, it isn't real hard evidence, but it's rock, and it's as hard as we are likely to get on something that's 4 billion years old. Pardon the pun. And they're right. I mean, it's very difficult to imagine just what would be convincing evidence over such a great time span. So the fact that it's weak, it's still all we've got, except for this other finding, which I'll mention. There are also some deposits of I believe it's a sedimentary rock that's been compacted, in which there are found individual little bubble-like formations scattered through what's otherwise a sort of homogeneous fused matrix. And it has been claimed that these little bubbles, these are again rocks of great age that are presumed to be several billions of years old. And on microscopic examination, there are seen these little inclusions, they're called, little bubbles in the rock, which it has been argued are primordial bacteria that were trapped in sediments and left a fossil imprint. Well, I don't think this evidence is all that great either, but a lot of people do hold to it. And the interesting thing is that both these sets of observations came into the scientific literature in a similar time frame, so they tended to reinforce each other. It was like, hey, I discovered life 4 billion years old, and he discovered it too. And the fact that there were two independent observations by different chains of inference in different geological formations that pointed to this possibility was that perhaps, I think more than anything else, made it appear scientifically credible. But that's pretty much the limit of evidence for life 4 billion years ago. This stuff engendered fairly heated debate when it came out. A lot of paleontologists said nonsense. A lot of people said great, wonderful, it must be true. I think the tendency is for younger scientists who are being educated now to accept it, probably because it has found its way into teaching programs in colleges and universities. From the viewpoint of the Urantia book, I would say probably the evidence has been misinterpreted, but I don't know enough about this specialty to really make an intelligent guess as to exactly how the evidence could have been misinterpreted. My point is there is an inconsistency. But whether it's a true problem remains, you know, whether this is right and this is not, remains for much more, it's going to require much more substantial evidence than anybody's gathered so far. To use his phrase, life about which we have a lot of data and a lot of information appears significant, certainly does start 550 million years ago or some number like that. This pushing it back to this frontier is based on a minuscule amount of evidence. The value of that evidence is not clear. I mean, from the Urantia book viewpoint, it's mistaken, but from a scientific viewpoint, it's as valid as anything they've got that is that old. So it raises questions in people's minds. And this is, in fact, the way science progresses, by, you know, having a theory that explains everything and then noticing an exception. And what's happened is they had a theory that said 550 million years ago, and that was it. And now they've got a little bit of data that goes much earlier. Well, they may discover something wrong with the data. They might discover a whole lot of stuff in between. If they discovered a whole lot of stuff in between, then it would bolster this. But the way it is, it's pretty weak. The Cambrian series of rocks and so forth were analyzed in the early 1800s. And the idea, you know, and the fossil structure was starting to be elicited and so forth. And there were English geologists in the early and middle 1800s that laid down the structures of the Cambrian and the Devonian and I guess it's the Permian, the major series of that we find all these early fossils in. And it was a lot of their work that led Darwin to formulate his theory of evolution, when all this evidence started to come out. Now, whether they didn't have the means to date it accurately at that time, in other words, they were dealing with the anecdotal evidence and trying to figure out how you fit it in between 4004 BC and 1840, but eventually it became clear you couldn't do that very well. And in more recent years, you know, using radiological dating, which started to be in the 40s, I would guess, started to really catch on. These dates have started to emerge. And by that I mean measuring the rates of decomposition of radioactive elements in the mother rock. You know, if the stratum is itself made of something that contains trace radioisotopes that they can make meaningful decay measurements about, then they can make a direct determination if it has not been contaminated by groundwater or exposure to the elements or something. Contamination is a real problem. also having appropriate chemical rock structures can be a problem, so they will also go to adjacent structures, you know, and date a whole series and see if they get the same answer across vertical and horizontal strata, which may indicate whether there's been water percolation through it or whether there are inconsistencies that have to be dealt with. Well, I'm not familiar with the detailed methods, but
the book tells us that we might encounter evidence of life in areas where there might not have been water because of the mixture of the strata.
Yeah, someone else brought that up to me. I don't know where the reference is. I don't mean that it isn't in there.
670.
That's the great thing about coming to the Boulder School, you know. You. In our study group, we could squabble about that for 3 weeks. Here, 670.
It's a geologic history book, section 7.
Yeah. And this is where it talks about the intrusion of other stuff and so on. Some are commingled with earlier, with subsequent layers. Topmost layers, some of the more primitive rock. And also the third paragraph. Average thing, somewhat. Many layers which have been described to this era belong to later periods, yeah. Okay, well, in any case, geology is an inexact science, you know, I mean. You can observe the rocks, but knowing what conclusions to draw can be difficult. There have been a lot of advances in radioisotope dating. The book does talk about the radium clock, I think, as being the best isotope dating mechanism. Certainly that's used. There are many others used. I don't know whether the book, you know, if it were written now, would criticize some of the other techniques as being inferior to the radium method. I suspect that they're not. But there is the question of contamination and so forth, and one good thing about the radium thing is perhaps it's less susceptible to contamination. John?
Yeah, doesn't the book say that if you were to date something that was 3.5 billion years old, would the Earth have been here 3.5 billion years?
Yeah. The book has the Earth about 4 or 5 billion years. It's when it's condensing or when it's being sucked out during the gravity explosion and then condensing. Yeah, it would have been here.
Would it have been possible for algae to have lived at that time even? Or any kind of form like that?
You mean the conditions on the Earth to be livable?
So.
Not according to the Urantia book. They say it couldn't support life, and they say the chemical and atmospheric conditions would prevent life 600 million years ago.
You mentioned earlier that one of the arguments might be that if it's correct, that it's a pre-life type form, it's not really life, so to speak.
Right, it might be some sort of bizarre physical, chemical process or something.
I mean, could have happened even 3.5 billion years ago.
I mean, there might have been some mechanism by which bubbles got, these micro bubbles that they see. I mean, they're undeniably micro bubbles in this stuff. Well, I mean, because the rock structure is otherwise very homogeneous, you know, it doesn't appear to have been foamed, you know. So why would there just be a few scattered bubbles in it? Of course, if there were zillions of germs, you would be full of germs, too. But it's just sort of a matter of how you want to look at the data, really, I think. Nobody was there. Nobody shot a video. You know? I mean, it comes to a question of what is sufficient evidence for it to stop being a theory and be a fact. Well, it's not always clear where that boundary's crossed. And that's what a lot of this problem is about. You know, one man's theory is another man's fact. And worse yet, in telling a true story, you have to be careful not to confuse yourself with the facts. And the appalling thing is that, you know, we recognize, that sounds absurd, and yet we recognize the truth in it ourselves, in that you use allegories and analogies and oversimplify things in order to convey the truth. And we do it in religious teaching and moral and ethical instruction all the time. Well, scientists do it too. They limit the amount of data they collect. They focus on a section of the problem that they can explain in an interesting way and ignore what they don't have enough data about. It's not interesting. And then later somebody gets more data about it and discovers they were all wrong, and then you have a revolution.